Today's episode is actually a recording of a talk given by World Bank economist Ugo Gentilini at GiveDirectly. He talks about a new book he has out called Timely Cash, which is an exhaustive history of cash aid and social protection programs, also known as welfare programs, throughout history from the Roman era all the way through to the present. It's a very interesting discussion. It also shows that there are a lot of biases or fears around people in poverty misusing cash that date back all the way centuries before today, and the role of evidence and research to dispel some of those myths and help us build a better and more modern social protection systems today. So I'll turn it over to Ugo.
It's a great pleasure to be with you today. Thank you for making time on a Friday morning or a Friday afternoon. We hope that we'll be able to squeeze in 2,500 years in 1 hour. Let's see how far we can go. And Miriam, before the call, he forwarded me a question. And it's a very hard question to me to answer, because the question was like, is Ugo a person or is he a website? I thought he was a website. I'm glad to confirm that in a way I'm both. I'm a human being, but also have this website that is sort of a repository of resources, many of which are the very papers, articles, and materials that you produce. So I think on behalf of all of those that work on cash transfers, I'm really grateful and appreciative for the work that you all conduct and that you push the boundaries. So thank you for your work. All right. So since I mentioned your work, among the many brilliant things that you do, I think that having a pilot that is 12 years in duration is pretty remarkable. And if you put on top of that, that you are testing a UBI, something that elicits a lot of discussion, but you are doing it in practice, that really comes with immense added value to all of us. And what you do in Kenya with mobile phones seems to be related to that little coin also that was in place, was minted in 483 BC. And that's a special coin. It's a coin that that Athens produced and distributed to everybody around that time. There was also a little island, an island state called Siphnos, that had a similar scheme, but basically Athens had a UBI financed through silver revenues already in 483. And a big champion of that scheme was Aristides, who's the guy on the right, pictured there in a painting by Friedrich Schmuglewitz of the 1700s. He was a big champion of the scheme. He really made the case about social cohesion and the importance of having cash paid directly to people at the time. There was also a big referendum that then, in a way, halted the program. But if you go back around those times and you read how Aristides articulated the case for UBI, it's quite fascinating. It has a number of continuities with what we hear today. So we, basically, the first cash transfer, as we know it, was a UBI, exactly what you're doing now in Kenya. And those continuities do not stop at UBI. The registries, the databases of beneficiaries that so many countries today have, like Indonesia, that used to uses those databases to identify and target the bottom 40% of the population with cash was something similar was present in the Chinese Empire around the year 1000, where communities and households were ranked based on wealth, based on the assets that they had. There was a ranking system, and in rural areas, transfers would be given to the bottom 40%, exactly like Indonesia today. There was a more refined system in urban areas where there were 10 categories, but still the bottom 40 would receive assistance. So a practice also in this case that dates back millennia. Paul, one of your colleagues and founder, has written a lot about cash transfers in India. And I think one of his proposals was to give the choice to people. Let them choose whether they prefer cash and food, whether they like to continue getting the PDS in-kind transfers or cash transfers instead. And that's exactly what the city of Toledo, 1546, did. They let people choose whether to get assistance in the form of cash or in-kind. The very notion of able-bodiedness, physical ability to work, which shapes up so many of the programs out there. Think of Ethiopia, Malawi, where you have this idea if you're physically able to work, you should get public works, if not direct transfers. That also has very long roots. Actually, it was legislated in 382 in the Roman Empire, but it really comes up in a more prominent way with the old poor laws of the 1600s England. Conditional cash transfers, I would argue, were not really introduced in Latin America in the 1990s. They were present, by the way, in Bangladesh in 1982, but in even earlier in the 1800s in Tuscany, there were examples of conditional cash transfers tied to vaccinations. And there were even other examples in Germany a few decades earlier. There is a lot of talk in OECD countries about guaranteed minimum income programs tied to inflation. You go back in 1795 in Spingham Land, an area in the US, in England, and you'll see that that program was introduced at that time, precisely providing a floor tied to the price of bread. And one last example, child benefits, so categorically targeted programs based on the number of children, untied to other welfare criteria, so much discussed these days, were present in the caliphate of Omar around the 1600s. And there were child benefit programs, but also a system, a registry, and a few other social protection components. So in the Middle East, also these programs were quite present many centuries ago. Now, if you take sort of the modern programs and the evidence behind them, I have this estimate that there have been 1.4 million papers written on cash transfers over the past 40 years. You'll see that recently, I mean, it's about 90,000 papers a year. So this is based on Google Scholar, on the Google Scholar database. And so I guess I'm able in the newsletter just to catch a few of those, considering this volume. But overall, as you know, the evidence is generally positive, of course, stronger in some dimensions, less in others. There are exceptions. But overall, if you look at the broad trajectory, cash transfers are supported by a favorable evidence base. But why is it then that despite all this history of practices and despite all the positive evidence, we're hearing over and over a recurrent set of critiques, a recurrent set of, I mean, the skepticism, the questions that are raised around these incentives. You present the evidence, but is that evidence really changing the mindsets? It seems that these questions have been there for a very long time. And that's basically what animated my my journey, my personal quest for understanding where these questions come from. How were they born? How did they spread? Why is it that they persist? And to do that, you need to look at history. You need to go back, try to understand what was going on. And so I, many years ago, I started this this adventure of writing the book. And what I discovered over time was that history, it's very important, especially in times like this, that we're living today, moments of instability, uncertainty, because history gives you roots. It gives you a certain stability. But it's also a thought-provoking discipline because it doesn't help you just with understanding the present, but it questions it. Why are things the way they are? It's like, little kids always ask the question, why? That's history keeps asking this question. It makes you think and makes you question the premises. And then, you know, you really are out there and you try not only to look at the practices that I just outlined, but you ask yourself the question, is there a pattern that is emerging across time and space? And that's what I'd like to discuss with you today, because there seems to me that there is this a general pattern coming up. And I believe that in a way we are in the middle of this pattern right now. So in order to get to the pattern, let me first show you how cash transfers were used in the past. What kind of goals did they pursue? And then we will go to the question of the pattern and see if there is this a certain dynamic that underpins all these different ways that cash transfers are being used. There are many ways in which you can articulate and structure the roles that cash transfers played in the past, but I have these three broad buckets of support the way in which countries transform their economies, how states build their capabilities, and how societies are using or used programs for social and political stability. So there are a number of themes also that are associated with these three buckets, but I'm just going to go very quickly through them. And in first, the first one, which I think is very much underestimated out there, if you think of the Industrial Revolution, you think of technology change, you think of urban-rural migration, you think of productivity enhancement, you don't think of cash transfers. And yet, there is work by historians that shows that the moment in England the transformation started, you needed a workforce to make it happen. And a sort of a social contract emerged where people, not voluntarily, but people relinquished their main source of security, which was land, and went to cities and got another source of security, which was in part the job, but also a state-provided system of cash assistance. However imperfect the old poor laws were, they helped putting a floor in society and helped workers stay in place in the very industrial areas where production occurred, and provided this form of security that was instrumental for economic transformation of the UK. This story of structural transformation, at the moment, the way it's described in various countries, I think that cash assistance is somewhat peripheral to that, but actually history shows that it was very much a central component as countries transformed from rural to mostly industrial powers. Another way of looking at the economic contribution of cash is the seminal initiatives on economic inclusion. So give directly in many places, Malawi and elsewhere provides one-off lump sums to people to bolster entrepreneurship. Similar initiatives were in place in Hamburg, Munich, Toulouse, St. Petersburg, where people were provided by the state with a set of tools and were organized to produce according to market principles. So we are accustomed to the idea of workhouses being punitive, prison-like sites, and that's exactly how they became in the 1800s. But before that, there was a whole generation of initiatives trying to organize the unemployed and try to help them produce something for the market. Now, the key point here is that these initiatives were underpinned by a philosophy whereby economic security, establishing a basic level of economic security, was a precondition for succeeding. Later on, we'll see it was exactly the opposite, is the need to keep people hungry and insecure in order for them to supply their labor. There was a moment in history where it was exactly the opposite. And here are some of the leading figures behind this philosophy of having economic security as a precondition for upward mobility. Isn't this the premise of so much of the cash transfer work that's being done today through pilots? So it goes back a few centuries. In terms of the second goal, so from economic to state building purposes, it's hard to link the history of cash transfers from that of crisis, and particularly food security crisis. The Indian Empire around the 250 BC had a very interesting system of anticipatory cash transfers, just like the ones recently evaluated in Bangladesh, where transfers were pre-positioned in anticipation of droughts. A lot of archaeologists have looked at this. So there was a system of a logistical pre-positioning of transfers so that they could be faster and more effective in drought response. All of this is narrated in inscriptions and other archaeological materials. Going back again to China, this is a classic graph that explains the modern extension of social protection systems horizontally and vertically, reaching more people, giving more transfers to those that are already receiving something. And also in this case, you see that China was quite advanced, both in expansion of coverage through weather forecasting, and again, in a spirit of anticipating transfers in the case of shocks already in the 1600s. And there were also the so-called poor houses that provided, that adjusted the generosity of assistance based on the age of beneficiaries. That's already in the around the 1100s. So that dynamic story of extension and adjusting according to risks was in place. The is famous for its food subsidies. Less told is the story of the Italian peninsula, my home country, that included about 44 towns that did have a cash transfer program called Alimenta that was provided to families with children and was financed progressively. The state would give capital to large landowners, and they would pay back the interest rates to the state, and the interest, the proceeds from the interest, was channeled back to communities by financing these programs. And they covered about 10% of the population at the time. And what you see there are two inscriptions, which are the registries. If you go to Rome or Parma, make a stop to one of the museums that I mentioned in the book. Check it out. It's an open-air social registry with the names of people receiving the transfers, the names of the landowners. These were put in the central square of those cities, and it's quite it's quite interesting to see how you know the value and importance that those societies put on transparency and letting people know exactly who's receiving what. Wars were also the triggers of sometimes cash assistance. The US is the premier case. If you look at the evolution of cash in the US, which, by the way, I think has a richer history than often assumed, they started with the War of Independence and the Civil War and payments to non-contributory payments to families of soldiers, and then they gradually evolved into the so-called mother pensions program, so assisting deserving mothers. And by the way, there is in the 1930s there is a there are 10 cities reaching about with programs reaching about 1.5 million people that experimented with replacing in-kind assistance with cash. So there is a book by Colcord that published in 1936 that goes into very in the detail of those comparative assessments in these 10 cities. Is it more effective to give cash? Is it more effective to give food? What is the comparative cost? So 100-year-old study illuminating many of the questions that we are all interested nowadays. The last bucket, giving providing social and political stability. I as part of this journey, and you get into the study of history, at some point, you're gonna face the issue of how cash transfers intersect with religions, because that also animates many of the principles that underpin current provisions, the idea of the work ethic, community solidarity, individual responsibility. They all have a philosophical in general and religious in particular aspect to it. Here is just a mapping on how some Catholic intellectuals thought about targeting adequacy, how to deal with situations of budget constraints. So the very questions that the state is asking today, who should receive assistance? How much? How do I rationalize programs if I have little money? Is exactly the questions that charity givers were facing and that religious intellectual opined upon. So I have a collection of those guidance notes that religious leaders issued in the past. Check it out because it's quite interesting. Now, there is also a negative side to the story, which is that sometimes cash transfers were used to cement existing disparities, inequities, discriminations, especially in colonial times. In this case, I looked at Fiji, at South Africa, or South Carolina in the US. You'll see that the provision of assistance was provided in line with the broader policy of differentiating between settlers and native populations. So there is also a darker side to the story, which is very important to acknowledge. High food prices, the idea of giving cash transfers to keep people calm and taming turmoils and protests, that's discussed extensively today. There is some econometric evidence on whether cash transfers in the past were effective, but I also devoted some time to see how, over especially in the past 40 years, cash transfers were increasingly part of the political discourse. They were seldom part of political campaigns until the 60s and 70s, and then they increasingly became part of that dynamic. And I explore a little more why that's the case and providing some recent examples. But it is fair to say that now cash assistance is ingrained in the political conversation that is occurring in a number of contexts in ways that we didn't see in the past. Now, take a step back a second and think of these three dimensions: economic transformation, state building, and societal and political stability. Is there something that binds them together? And I have to admit that when I started the book, you never know what you're going to find when you start researching, right? Sometimes you start with some certain goals and you end up with something else. In my case, I started by really documenting the practices, but then the more you advance and the more you see that there are these recurring issues, and the recurring issues that seem to emerge in these 2,500 years of cash assistance is one where there are certain forces, structural forces that generate poverty. Cash transfers are helping to address these forces for some time. There is a moment when policymakers, society, becomes frustrated because to give cash and yet poverty still exists, those structural forces are still active. Now, cash transfers have a number of advantages, but those structural forces need something else as well to be addressed. But this coexistence between giving cash and poverty still in place creates frustration. And there is a moment when causality is switched in actually, cash transfers become the problem, and so do people receiving them. Maybe it's cash assistance itself that creates and perpetuates poverty. So here we go with a process of restricting assistance, making it more difficult to access. And the objective becomes getting people off the rolls. independently or whether their living conditions have improved. What happens to those people? Maybe some are able to enter the labor market. Many end up in coping strategies, including crime, increasing the cost for society, and having to pay for prisons, the increasing cost of health and hospitalizations, the increasing cost for civil societies and families that bear the brunt of the retrenchment of the state, until the point when these needs again are so visible that we start again with a cycle of cash provisions. This, in my mind, is something that you see back in the past, centuries ago. It's almost attached to human nature. It's not attached to geography. It's not attached to a particular period. It seems to be part of us. And we are somewhere in this cycle today. So I also map out specific ways in which institutions have been reducing those provisions and make them tighter precisely because of this frustration with cash transfers, maybe not helping, but being part of the problem. So if cash transfers are part of the problem, you need to rationalize them, make eligibility stricter, and push people off the rolls. And the 1500 Europe, the 20 plus city states that at the time basically took over responsibilities for cash provisions from ecclesiastical authorities, from the church, on the basis that the church was overly generous, and the structural transformations that were in place at the time, and the covariate shocks, pandemics, wars, they had created so much needs. And the church was trying to serve and help, but the demand for assistance largely outstripped the capacity to provide them, meet them, created chaos. And a very direct way of trying to reestablish order and discipline was to take over this provision of cash by city states and said, you know, as city states, we are better able to ascertain scientifically who deserves and who doesn't. And here, the blueprint that was established at the time, it resembles very closely the way in which we think about the whole decision-making process in who, why, where, how much transfer should be provided. By the way, there was a great learning network between these cities, so they were learning from each other, and cross-fertilizing experiences. It worked also the other way. New York in the late 1800s had a set of NGOs that were able to initiate a new way of thinking about provisions, just like the city states in the 1500s, based on charity giving. Great work here by sociologists and anthropologists like Viviana Zelizer and others that really recount. There is, by the way, a journal called Charity Organization Review. It stopped, I think, printing around in 1906 or 7. There are many editions before. If you go back there, you really get the vivid, a vivid illustration of what it means and how cash was organized at the time through support of this of NGOs that were criticizing the state this time for being overly indiscriminate in provisions, was to organize the city around poverty districts, which districts were most in need, and then having people visiting household conditions and verifying exactly what is needed. And it was a structured way to think about provisions, and NGOs actually were leading thinkers in New York in the late 1800s. The US also
Cool.
in
Sorry
the
to interrupt. Do you think we could quickly go to Q&A in a minute or so, just to give people some
I
time?
think a minute will be
Great.
sufficient.
Thank you.
Let me maybe, David, go here just to say that if you were to think of the mother of reforms, the most influential reform of cash assistance, I think, in modern times is 1834 England, a reform that included the production of a famous report that was reviewing all previous practices and that was heavily influenced by the fathers of economics, who, by the way, were no supporters of cash assistance. That report was supposed to pave the way for a new legislation on cash. And it was, and the intention was to base the content on surveys, both in the UK and overseas. That report was an ideological statement. The findings of the report leaked out and were actually published in a piece before the survey data was in. And the whole point was to indict cash assistance as the problem for poverty and not as an instrument to help addressing it. That report was incredibly influential, and despite the revisionist evidence that followed, in many other places. Think of Sudan in 1920s, famine response in India, and many others. The blueprint of that report is tapped for modern critiques of cash transfers. Go and see that report, 1834, the Royal Commission report, and you'll just see the same words that are used today. And this is my last slide. I feel that there is a lot more that cash has been doing in development than is currently acknowledged. The role in economic transformation is one, but they really come out as an underdog, have been supporting a lot, doing a lot, but not really acknowledged and appreciated. Cash transfers are debated because ultimately the poverty problem is debated. We don't have a coherent way, a unified way, a consensus around why poverty exists and how it spreads. If there is contention around that, it's obvious that also the instruments supposed to address it are contentious themselves. And if you look at the overall trajectory in history, you clearly see that while they're not perfect, and while of course there are cases when cash transfers haven't been doing well, overall the direction in causality is clear. Cash transfers are not the problem. Cash transfers are a response for a wider problem, largely caused by structural issues. And the process of retrenchment, of having indicting cash transfers for the problem of poverty, has huge societal costs. People that get excluded from programs ultimately increase the cost for societies because crime increases, because health deteriorates, because they become a burden for other parts of society, including NGOs, including families. So the cost for the government may go down, the cost for societies goes up. Big issue for all of us. At the heart of this, it's the role of economic security or insecurity as the premise for how development happens. So far, the main narrative has been that needs some form of insecurity so that people supply their labor. Does that still hold true? Many, a lot of the work that you yourself are doing is openly channeling, challenging this this notion. You're saying you actually need some basic level of security because people need to access jobs, and you need the they need transport, they need good nutrition, they need a roof over their head. And those are preconditions for people to thrive. That narrative hasn't been sticky enough in my mind. So far, the other narrative still dominates. That's the challenge for today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hugo. Incredibly insightful. I'll turn it over to folks from the audience. Do you guys have any questions? Would love for you to unmute yourselves or put it in the chat. I'll give you a few minutes. Go for it, Michael.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Hugo. That was absolutely fascinating. I didn't think I'd have another reason to hate the 1834 poor laws after being forced to study it as a 17-year-old, but here we are. It's nice to see that circle back in my life. I really enjoy like having the long view of anything, but I was wondering how you think this sort of long view could be used in the sort of advocacy or framing of cash in the modern day. There's sort of two things that jump out. One is that sometimes what we do is presented as this like crazy new thing that's like never going to work. So like showing that it goes back thousands of years is quite a powerful rebuttal to that. And then secondly, do you think maybe there's something around like framing the modern critiques of cash as like echoing, you know, Victorian views on poverty? And my hunch is that most people, regardless of their position, wouldn't like to see their modern critiques framed in that way. I'm just wondering if you have any more, like, what do you think of those ideas or other practical ideas about how we use this sort of historical long view in the modern discussion? Thanks.
And maybe we can take a couple more questions, if that's okay, at the same time. Isabel, do you want to go for it?
Sure. Hi. I'll just say a quick hi, Hugo. I'm in a car, so I'm not sure you can see me. On the way back from a very interesting trip, actually, exploring maybe a new frontier for cash transfers, which is looking at how they can drive conservation outcomes, which is quite a sort of challenging framework to think through. But also lots of in the past, I'm sure, as well. I had quite a similar question to Michael, so I won't delve on that deep, although maybe I'll just add an additional dynamic, which is like, you know, right now we, especially over the last year or so, we have had this enormous pressure to make the case for evidence-based, cost-effective forms of development at a time of huge aid cuts, et cetera. And I just wonder, you know, especially we have a very dynamic comms team here at Githerity, and I just wonder if you have any sort of, yeah, any ideas on how we can use this wealth of evidence in a really compelling way with the public, who ultimately informs, in many countries at least, informs decisions on public financing. But perhaps another reflection is, you know, when you were talking about the different, let's say, goals of the use of cash transfers, you would referencing economic transformation. And I just wonder whether you have any reflections on how that can be framed in the era of AI, and, you know, bring back up again this idea of universal basic income in the era of AI, and what learnings might be applicable from your research. Thank you.
Could you maybe take those first, Hugo, since they're related to each other, and then we'll go to Jasmine, Gregory, and Carolina.
Thank you, Isabel, for connecting from the car, and thank you, Michael, for bringing back those memories. I think that what might be helpful is to show that cycle, because in a way, history gives sense of direction and maybe a glimpse at what's around the corner. And the conversation with a policymaker that yes, may have its skepticism, and one tries to understand what says, and sometimes it's for good reasons. But I think that the idea of we have been here, and not only in terms of the fact that cash has a long history per se, so the practicalities of doing it, but the fact that, hey, if you don't, if you have, if you start with this, we start with these programs, beware that there might be a moment that if the underlying structural issues are not being addressed, you might end up in this other place. And from there, you may end up in this other place. And we are full circle back. I think it's a call for action. I think it's a call for boldness. I think it's a call for, I mean, it's a responsibility, right? For all of us collectively. To learn from history means understanding also how to break out of it. And we need to tackle, I think, the broader point of the generators of poverty. You can have one instrument and try to positioning it within that framework, but it needs to be part of a broader mobilization, a broader vision, because if that's not the case, after some gains, we're soon going to be in square one, back to square one. So it's a call for everyone to take part of this new call for addressing what is a long-standing issue. And the what I ended up it really boils down to that is if you were to address that big problem, how would you, what would be needed in the first place? Do people need a basic level of security, or do you need to keep them in a level, in a state of insecurity? And try to see where you stand on this, and try to see how cash transfer programs may contribute to that, and involve others, because I think the idea that cash transfers can do it all by itself is a very challenging statement. Try to see how this is part of something else. Too often, I think cash transfers are seen as a shortcut that look like they are addressing a big problem, but that problem is going to come back one way or the other. And that's what history shows.
It's a great point, Hugo. Thanks. All right, Jasmine.
Thanks, Hugo. And thanks for the whole talk. It's been really cool. I think one of the things, and like your last point is a great segue to this question. You like, it sounds like you position a lot as a theoretical debate on what we do about poverty. But as a researcher, is there any, in the thousands of years of cash transfers, is there any piece of evidence that you think is missing from the discourse about cash transfers? Or do you think we've got it all on the research?
Nice. Can we take a couple more at a time as well? Caroline, I think your hand was next.
Sure. Hi, Hugo. Thanks for this. I lead the design of our large transfer programs. And so my question is on the historical analogs of large transfers. You know, who has been giving the most money in history? If we think of our large transfers as like enough to buy 2 to 3 durable assets, and I know, has anybody been had that sort of intent and size? What are the best analogs?
And Greg, Gregory? Gregory, do you have a question? All right, Ugo, you can get started, I think. Oh, sorry, there's one question in the chat on data of around cash versus in-kind aid, which I think you touched about in your on in your presentation, but if you want to expand on it.
See,
Yeah.
Gregory is unmuted.
Oh yeah, thanks. Sorry, my mic was acting up. I just wanted to say that my questions is in line with Jasmine's question, so we're good.
Okay, so thank you, Gregory. Starting with you, so I on the evidence of cash versus in kind, so there are a few instances when I raise that, but I think the best documented case is the period between 1934, 1933, 1935, US. So check out that volume by Joanna Colcord. It's available for free online. You just Google it and it'll pop up as a PDF. You'll see those 10 cities and how they have replaced in kind with cash. There are many different types of in kind. They're called commissionaries. There are four or five models. You'll see how cities replace that with cash and the results and the cost estimates. What's also interesting is that the cash component of that were managed by NGOs. And after this process of study and replacement, many of the NGO staff that had knowledge on how to handle cash were absorbed into state departments, municipalities. There was I think that's important to acknowledge, because later on there would be a moment in the US history, especially in the 60s, when this issue comes back. So it's a great case, not only of research but also of institutional knowledge transfer between providers. So I really recommend that volume by Joanna. Carolina, your question, I would say look at the China 18 the year 1080, more or less. A policy that was called the Green Sprouts Loans. It was a policy whereby large transfers were given with the purpose of spurring entrepreneurship. That generated a conversation in society at the time on the role of the state in bolstering micro entrepreneurship, mean industrial policy. A lot of debate on, oh, is this what really the state should do? Isn't this the role of the financial sector? Isn't this the role of private sector? More than 1,000 years ago, I think you'll see the resemblance or many traits of today's discussion on capital injection to small businesses and to people in the form of the lump sums that are very similar to that, but also Munich in the 1700s and Hamburg around the same period. They're also fascinating in proposing similar approaches. So I would say this three. And Jasmine, how could you ever put a limit to research? There are zillions questions I think that would be interesting to explore further. I don't want to say that in any way we have preempted the exploration, but I would say we are at a good point in having a general sense of what works. What is interesting to me is that if we move beyond the notion of cash works, but what specific designs work for different populations in different contexts, then you have now multiple dimensions to work with, where you take one instrument, cash, and you see in context A, B, C, or D, and then you look at different designs, A, B, C, and D for each context, and you'll see that the outcomes might differ quite a lot. And of course, there is a role for design as well, and all the different transfer size and frequencies that can lead to very different outcomes. I have sort of a map of the evidence in the book where I try to use my very imperfect judgment in saying which are the areas that we know less and which are the areas that we are better off. Which are the ones that are most studied? Which are the ones that are least studied? So I try to map that out, but I still think there is a lot that can be uncovered on the specifics, even if some of the broad themes have been reasonably studied by now. But there are still infinite possibilities out there.
Google, do you have a hard stop at 9 now? Can you stay on for a few more minutes?
I can stay on for a few
Okay.
minutes, yes.
Miriam, I'll turn it over to you if you want to close it with a question or anything for those who have a hard stop.
Yeah, for those who have a hard stop, I just want to do a marketing pitch. So you must all agree with me that Google did a lot of research into this to put everything in one place. And let's buy the book. It's available, Oxford Press. It's available on Amazon, anywhere you get your books. The Kindle version is out. Then the bookstores, you look really smart if you go to a bookstore and buy a copy and walk out with it. Everyone is going to be awed by you. And then there's also an audio version. I've just been reliably told that the narrator is excellent. Like for those of us who like audiobooks, the narrator makes or breaks the book. The author for this one is amazing. So let's support Google. Let's buy this book and yeah, talk about cash. So thanks, Google.
Thanks for
Back
the
to the question.
feedback.
Yeah.
And yeah, for those who have to drop out, please do so. But if those of you who want to and can stay, there's a couple more questions in the chat that I'll get into. Caroline asks, if you can't read it, Ugo, if this has been in government agendas for many years, what haven't we done right to create continuity and improvements in delivery, as opposed to investing a lot of energy in changing the minds of skeptics? And then I will back to the research point. Despite so much research showing effects, why has this evidence alone been insufficient, and what are the role that narratives have played in driving this adoption?
Yeah, it's a they're yeah, the Green Sprouts is a good brand. on the points of narratives and mindsets, I'll be very honest. The book is not an advocacy piece. The book is my own journey to try to understand. And I had to stop at some point because it was time to wrap it up. But I very much feel that I could have gone on for forever. I think there is. If you try to convince someone about something, I think you start in a position of disadvantage already. It looks like you want to sell something. I would say none of us have complete certainty and a complete understanding of the world. Start by being curious about how and why others think about an issue. And certainly they care just like us about that issue. When I see campaigns of, oh, I need to convince you about the merits of cash. If I'm a skeptic, you bet that my door is already closed. Try to understand where I come from first. Try to understand why I see the world the way I see it. Try to be in my shoes. That's what the book is about. I'm trying to understand how mindsets are formed. And I try not to judge those mindsets. we'll find sometimes a lot of good things and things that we don't know coming from precisely the people that we might disagree with. At the same time, that process also leads you to see these broad patterns and the fact that cash transfers are a scapegoat for things that are often beyond their control. If we can agree on what's the nature of the problem that we want to address, and what's the specific role that cash transfers can play within that broader problem, I think we're going to have a more constructive conversation than trying to go with a sales pitch and convince others. The narrative that comes out of this approach might be the result of two worldviews that come together. I think we should be more open to accept that others can disagree, but just let's find a common ground on how we think about this joint problem that we are facing. And if that's be, in a way, more a naive and curious student and less of an experienced salesman. That would be my bottom line, because the moment that we think we know it all, that's the moment when we stop learning. And what drives us is being curious. And I can, in what this process of writing the book taught me, is that we are a final tale of a community of practitioners that stretches over centuries. Think how many generations of people have thought, done, and lived through these debates before us. So that's very humbling. In my mind, it's very humbling to see the debates haven't changed a lot. So I would say, let's stay humble, stay curious, be open-minded about other views, and together try to really address this question of the nature of poverty and how it reproduces itself, and the role of cash within that. Don't start from cash, start from the problem.
I think that's a great place to end it. Unless Miriam, you wanna also say any few closing words?
Oh no, that philosophy set ending was amazing. Thank you very much, Ugo. Amazing.